So, I'll just go straight to, do you have any questions on stuff that's been happening?
So, I have a question. I attended one of the Erickson's talks. Can I ask you something?
Yeah, okay. Which one? The one yesterday?
No, the one on Monday.
On Monday, okay.
And so there's this idea that nature is somehow a computer.
Okay.
And it was just, I guess I'm new to this idea, or in what sense could nature be a computer?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, so it's the phrase, okay, so first of all, I'm sure that if Scott were saying something like that, he would say that nature is a quantum computer. Right. So sometimes people like Seth Lloyd will say this type of thing, but it's a little vague exactly what he means. To the extent that I would say something like that, I mean, what do we need for a computer? Well, it should take some information and it should process it into something else. But when we think of a computer, we really think of a programmable computer. So it doesn't necessarily have to be universal in the sense that we've been talking about, but it should be somehow that there's something you can do to it to design a particular computation. If you are willing to waive that, then well, everything that physics does is computing some function, right? It's kind of simulating itself, right? Which is, I was going to say, not very interesting. It's not very interesting maybe from a computational point of view, but of course it's interesting from a physics point of view. But you know, then once you start to tweak it, you can get it maybe to simulate some other system. And what Scott was talking about was more along the lines of, well, you know, we have a lot of control in a linear optics system, right? We can put the beam splitters where we want. We can, you know, take the different modes and send them through optical fibers to cross and go into whichever beam splitter we want. And therefore, we have a lot of control over kind of the computation that this thing is doing. So it's probably a matter of interpretation in that, you know, if you just found this thing lying around, you might not say it was a computer. Whereas if you built it, you might say, well, I built it to do this, and therefore it's computing this function for me. OK. Questions on the class? No? OK. So then maybe I'll get started with the lecture while people are still walking in. OK. So remember last time we talked about density matrices and POPMs and quantum operations. And so I'd like to pick up a little bit from where that left off and then take it in a slightly different direction. But OK. So quantum operation, you remember. It had to be positive. It had to be trace preserving. And it has to be completely positive. OK. So what I'd like to start by talking about is why we really need this third condition. Remember, complete positivity was a statement that, so I guess quantum operation, let's call it S. It's a statement that S tensor I is positive. So why doesn't this just follow from the fact that S is positive? It seems maybe a little silly to have to drag around this extra system all the time. But this really is necessary. And in fact, there are maps, including some very simple ones, that are positive but not completely positive. So in particular, the transpose is one such map. Okay. So, well, how do you know it's positive? Well, if you have some density matrix rho, and you take the transpose, well, this is the same, of course, as taking the complex conjugate, because rho is Hermitian. So rho star is still a Hermitian operator, right? That hasn't really changed that property. In particular, if you diagonalize rho, well, taking the transpose is not going to change the diagonal matrix. So the eigenvalues are the same. Right? And in particular, if they're non-negative eigenvalues, they stay non-negative. So this is that proves that transpose is a positive map. Okay? But look what happens if you have a composite system like this, and you take the transpose on part of that. So for instance, let's take the state 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. One of favorite states in quantum information. Okay, so the density matrix of this is 1, 0, well, it's a half up front, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay? And if we take the partial transpose, so say on the A system, that's equal to, well, what we have to do is we have to divide this up into 2 by 2 submatrices and take the transpose of each one of those. That's because we're only doing the transpose, remember, on the A subsystem. So we switch the A bra and ket, but not the B bra and ket. So okay, so in this upper left corner we get still 1 0 0 0, and this lower right corner we get 0 0 0 1. So that stays the same. But here the ones go towards the middle. And if you stare at this a little while, you can see that it's not a positive matrix anymore, right? Because basically, look, it's block diagonal. And this 2 by 2 block has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1, right? So in particular state, let's see, I guess it's 0, 1, minus 1, 0 has negative eigenvalue minus 1. Okay? So even though transpose is a positive when restricted to just a single system, when you act it on a composite system, it's sick. It doesn't take density matrices. This is not a valid density matrix anymore. It doesn't take density matrices.
The density matrix of the whole system, does that factor in an obvious way so that we can actually do the transpose on the A system?
Sorry, what do you mean? So the density matrix, does it factor? So the point is that, so remember we're assigning our basis state something like this. Okay? And 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And so for instance, this term represents a 1, 1, 0, 0 term, if you were to write it in Braquet notation. And then taking the partial transpose means we want to switch the A part. So this becomes 0, 1, 1, 0, which is
yeah,
here.
That's what I mean.
Okay. Now, I mean, the density matrix as a whole is a sum of things like that. But the transpose is a linear operator, so we can just treat each term in the sum separately. Okay? So does everyone understand how I did this? And does everyone understand why I did this? Yeah, okay.
This is very stupid. Maybe we should let's get out for class. But like, so usually the transpose, like abstractly the transpose, if you have a map from real vector space to real vector space, you can take you can take the transpose. But like, you know, you want a map that goes back, it's like the adjoint induced by the inner product. Anyway.
For real vector space.
Right. So these are maps from complex vector spaces to complex vector spaces. And it's not obvious
yeah.
to me. what the transpose is here?
Well, okay, so if you write it, so that's a very good question. So if you write it like this, I mean, I hope it's clear what the transpose is, right? If I write it like a matrix, you just take the transpose. The catch is that the transpose is actually a basis-dependent operation. So I'm cheating a bit. And this argument about the same eigenvalues was definitely cheating. But it's true. It has the same eigenvalues.
Does that mean that this is not a well-defined map, or what?
Like, no, it's perfectly well-defined. Okay. It's just I haven't told you the complete definition, which is that you take the transpose, say, in the computational basis.
Okay.
But the important thing is that it doesn't matter what basis you define it in.
Yeah.
The transpose is still not a completely positive map.
Okay.
In any basis, it's not a completely positive map. Well, in this particular, I'll get to this in a second. But in this particular case, it doesn't matter what state. But in general, you can always find some state like this, some composite state of the composite system that will become negative under the action of the partial transpose. Okay. So there are questions on this so far. More questions. Okay, so then the next question is, well, what kind of state becomes negative? Right? Is it just a general state, or is it only some special states? And if you think about it, well, it has to be a state that really is taking advantage of the compositeness of the system, right? If you have a tensor product state. I guess we can use density matrix, so rho tensor sigma. Right? Well, under partial transpose, that would go to rho transpose tensor sigma. And rho, I mean, transpose, remember, is positive map. So if you just act on the first system, you'll get rho transpose is another valid state. And so this is also a valid state. Okay? So on tensor product states, the transpose works fine. It gives you valid states again. So what you really need to get a state that is bad for the transpose is an entangled state. Okay, so people have used this property to use the transpose, particularly the transpose, but in principle you can do it with other maps that are positive but not completely positive, to detect entanglement. And indeed, for qubits, well, for qubits, transpose is basically up to some other CP map. Is basically the only map that's not positive, that's positive but not completely positive. So for qubits, having negative partial transpose. Is frequently abbreviated NPT, is both sufficient and necessary. For the state to be entangled. Okay, sure.
In this argument here. where we resorted to Bell 00 and took partial transpose,
we didn't actually rely on not taking the complex conjugate as well. So would that argument work for a patient?
So the partial adjoint. I mean, I suppose in this case it would. So I never thought about that. See, the problem is that the adjoint is not actually a linear operation. It's an antilinear operation. Okay, because if you have, I mean, it's kind of not very relevant for density matrices where you frequently take, I mean, it is relevant, but density matrices are Hermitian, so if you want to add them together, you should take real coefficients. But in general, it's a complex vector space. And so if you have a complex coefficients and you take the adjoint, then you have to take the complex conjugate of those coefficients. It's antilinear, not linear. Which doesn't, you know, dramatically change this, but I mean, I suppose you could use it like to detect entanglement in a similar way. But I don't know if that's been studied or not. It might have been. There's been a lot of studies of entanglement, and I'm just not an expert in that. So.
Just kind of a red flag goes up when,
When we kept talking about transpose without.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, I think I missed something writing thing down. So negative state, you mean like negative norm states?
Negative, what were you thinking? Here.
Sorry.
So like density matrices with, well, kind of density matrices, but with negative eigenvalues. There's not, I mean, I haven't defined any kind of norm on these things.
Oh, all right, because the point is, well.
But they will have. I'm sure it behaves pathologically under some sorts of norm, but basically I just mean states that are so. We say a matrix is positive if it has, you know, non-negative eigenvalues or greater than equal to zero, non-negative eigenvalues, and so it means no longer satisfying that. No, the transpose is trace preserving. In the particular case, the trace was
oh, sorry, right.
One.
Yes.
And
no, no,
still.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, so for qubits, as I said here, having negative partial transpose is sufficient and necessary to detect entanglement. But it turns out that's not true for larger systems. So I think already in D equals 3, there are examples of states, of entangled states, which still have positive partial transpose. But if it has negative partial transpose, well, it can't be a tensor product state, which means it has to be entangled, basically. So it's sufficient, but not necessary. Okay. So let me talk a little bit more about what it actually means to be entangled. And in fact, that will kind of be the main topic of this lecture. So first of all, for a pure state, I've kind of already given you the definition. So a pure state psi is entangled if it's not a tensor product state. Okay. So one interesting aspect of this is if it is a tensor product state, that implies that if you look at only part of this, you have, again, a pure state. Right? So right, and similarly for row B. Okay? Whereas if you have any other kind of state and you trace over part of it, you'll get a mixed state. Okay? So when you have the global pure state, that's a clear way to distinguish between entangled and unentangled states. Yeah.
Is a tensor product with another state is not entangled. Like in the case, you can take phi a to be entangled state based. Such a tensor product.
Right. So yeah. So whether it's entangled or not in this type of picture depends on how you're breaking up the system. So you're imagining a case where maybe we have, you know, 3 qubits or 4 qubits, and if you look at the first 2 qubits, that's an entangled state of those 2 qubits. But then it's an tensor product of the 3rd qubit, and that's perfectly possible. And if you start to look at systems that can be broken up in multiple different ways, then entanglement becomes a much more subtle and complicated matter. And nobody really has a full grasp of how to classify entanglement in that case. So I will just stick for today, just stick to a case where we're only breaking up the system in one way. We have, you know, Alice and Bob, and we only care about entanglement between Alice and Bob, and not, you know, within Alice's system or within Bob's system. Okay, so this is for a pure state. What about a mixed state? Pure state entanglement is actually fairly simple, and to the extent that I can give you a pretty good characterization of it, although I won't give you a complete one today. But mixed state entanglement is much, much more complicated. Let me at least define it, though. That we can do. Well, OK, this definition doesn't apply just for mixed states. It also applies for pure states. But it's most relevant for mixed states. So we say that mixed state or pure state, in general, a density matrix rho of two subsystems, so it's rho AB, is separable if it can be written as a mixture of tensor product states. Maybe I should call this something else. Same with tensor A to B. Okay? So these two things. I wanted to change the name because these two things certainly don't have to be the same in any sense. And I have to index them by I because there could be many of them. Okay. So what does this mean? Well, sigma and eta must be density matrices. So they're valid states of A and B. And so what this is saying is that this is something that we can kind of prepare without involving any entanglement between the systems, right? Because we can just generate some random number. And with probability ci, Alice puts in the state sigma I, and Bob puts in the state eta I. Okay, and they don't need to have any quantum resource. They have to talk classically to be able to do this, because they need to agree on what I is. But other than that, they don't need any quantum resource. So this is kind of the mixed state analog of this tensor product state. That's not totally fair. States like this can have correlations. They can have classical correlations. But they don't really have any quantum correlations. Although what exactly one means by that is still quite subtle. And in some ways, they do have quantum effects, just not, you know, the type of fully quantum effects you'd expect from an entangled state. Everything I'm saying about mixed states could be taken with a grain of salt, not because I don't know what I'm doing, but because no one really understands even bipartite mixed state entanglements. There's just lots of different kinds of it, and people keep discovering kind of new, slightly weird phenomena. Okay, and then a mixed state is entangled. If it's not separable. Okay. So does everyone understand this definition? So it's worth noting that for pure states, well, at least, you know, if the dimension is not too large, you can write down the density matrix, take the partial trace, and see whether you have a pure state left over. Right? And that's relatively easy to do. But to see if it's separable, well, you have to look at all possible different combinations of states like this. And that's really very hard, even for modest dimensions. Yeah. I don't think it has an actual name. It's this separable decomposition from
the Schmidt.
The Schmidt, right?
No, it's not. It's not. So the Schmidt decomposition is first of all that applies to pure states, pure entangled states, not mixed states.
Okay.
And second of all, it puts constraints that all the states that appear in the Schmidt decomposition have to be. This particular state, because it has degenerate eigenvalues, has lots of Schmidt decompositions. But in general, the Schmidt decomposition is of this form. You have, let's just put lambda I here, I tensor I, right? And so these I's form an orthonormal basis for A and for B. These things don't. They can be just pretty much anything. Literally, they can be anything that are valid density matrices. And again, this decomposition doesn't have to be unique. In general, it's not going to be. This is unique when the eigenvalues are all different. So these lambda i's are the eigenvalues of, say, the marginal density matrix on one side. This is very useful, but I was not really going to go into it in this class, because I guess Rob Speckens did in his class, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Factorization dependent? Like,
So again, you think of the case where you have kind of multiple subsystems and you might be breaking it up in different ways?
Well, even if you just have two subsystems, like,
if you have two subsystems.
You can always factor in different ways, right?
Well, if you have two subsystems implicitly, that's saying you have a particular factorization. Right? Let's take a simple example, right? You have, Alice has a five-dimensional Hilbert space, and Bob has a five-dimensional Hilbert space. And then you're writing the global 25-dimensional Hilbert space as Alice's Hilbert space tensor Bob's Hilbert space. Okay. So in that case, there is a unique tensor product decomposition. Unless you want to take, a zero-dimensional or one-dimensional Hilbert space complex number as tensor 25-dimensional. That's because I picked the numbers 5 to 5, which were prime. Now, if you have an eight-dimensional Hilbert space, there's a lot of ways. There's three different ways to break that up. There's a lot of ways to break that up into a four-dimensional tensor, a two-dimensional. Sorry, for the 20, yeah, okay. Now I see what you're saying. No, for 25 dimensional open space, there's still also lots of other ways to break it up into a five dimensional tensor, five dimensional. But the point is that Alice has her five dimensional subspace, and Bob has his five dimensional subspace, and that determines the decomposition. Well, yeah, but see, so then, in order to get a different decomposition, you'd have to look at, say, a subspace which was entangled between the original Alice and Bob version. So it's not just like Alice could rotate her subsystem. No, if you rotate it locally, that'll keep the same.
Alice and Bob have to rotate their subsystems into each other.
Yeah, so they have to rotate them into each other, and then that would be different. But yes, so this is saying on particular decomposition. And I should say that whereas the computational basis is not always a very well-defined thing, it's a convenient thing, this kind of decomposition into tensor product states, or to tensor product Hilbert spaces, seems like it's kind of artificial. There's a lot of ways of doing it. In fact, in practice, there's frequently very natural ways to decompose into subsystems. And this is because, you know, your quantum information might be stored in a series of different physical systems, right? Like you have one atom, which is your first qubit, and another atom, which is your second qubit, and that's a natural decomposition. There are other systems that don't have a natural tensor product decomposition. Sometimes you want to kind of impose one, and then it becomes artificial. But in a lot of systems, it really is natural. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Are there constraints on C's?
Well, so this thing has to be traced one.
So it's some over C as well.
And actually, the CIs, it's a good point. The CIs have to be non-negative. Basically, the CIs are probabilities. CI greater than 0, some CI. Yeah, so actually this one is important, that they're non-negative. This one is kind of implicit by the fact that this is trace one. But this one is non-trivial. And if you don't include that, then you're doing something wrong. Yeah?
You said there are no question on the DC side AB with the basis and
facts
with sigma A
and. Yes.
Sorry. So yes. If you want the trace to be one,
I'm the only constraint I'm imposing is that they're valid states, that they're density matrices. So they each do have trace one. And they're, you know, positive with Hermitian. But other than that, there's no constraint. Okay? So let's move on. So because mixed state entanglement is pretty complicated, I'm going to kind of leave it. And if you're interested in it, there's an infinite amount of reading you can do. I mean, literally, of course, it's finite, but probably there are enough papers still being written. It's not as fashionable today as it used to be, but there's probably still enough papers being written on mixed state entanglement that if you started reading them, you would never get to the end.
Are most of these papers worth reading?
Most of the papers? No, not worth reading. But there's some that are. I mean, if you have any field that has thousands of papers, most of them are not going to be worth reading. It's not necessarily restricted to the field of entanglement. Okay. So what I want to talk about now is pure state entanglement, and to get a better handle on quantifying it. So in principle, this is a relatively easy thing to do, right? You take the state, you trace over part of it, and first of all, if you just want to see whether it's entangled or not, you can see whether you get a pure state left over. So how do you do that? Well, one easy way is that pure states are projections. Right? So if you have if your row is a pure state, row A. If row A is a pure state, phi. Sorry, try to be consistent in my notation here. So if rho A is a pure state, then rho A squared is this, right? Just writing that twice. And this is 1. So this is equal to rho A again. OK? So that's a pretty easy test. I mean, if you write rho A in some kind of arbitrary basis, well, it may not be immediately obvious that it's a pure state, right? A pure state, if it has, you know, a 1 in somewhere in the diagonal and zeros elsewhere, well, then it's clear it's a pure state. But if it has, you know, numbers everywhere, it might not be immediately obvious. But you can do a very simple test. You can just square it and see if you get back to the original thing. Okay? So that's an easy test of whether you have a pure state or not, and therefore whether you have an entangled state or not. You take a partial trace and square. Yeah?
You even have to go that far. Can you take a trace of the square so that you don't have to compare every single element?
And trace of the square will also work, in fact. It's a measure of purity. So trace of the square is nice in another sense, in that if it's not pure, it kind of gives you some notion of how far you are from pure. But I was actually going to use a different quantity, which admittedly is more difficult to calculate than trace of the square. But it has some very nice properties. And it's called the entropy. You've probably heard of it. OK. So the entropy is defined as minus trace rho log rho. And in quantum information, well, we have, you know, this computer science side to us, so we like to use the binary entropy and take log base 2. Relative to, you know, natural log, it's just the only difference is a factor of log 2. A natural log of 2. So it's just some constant thing. So this, of course, is the von Neumann entropy. And well, it really is the same as the entropy that appears in thermodynamics. So why is this a good measure of whether we have an entangled state and how far we are from the entangled state? Again, I'm taking the density matrix of a subsystem. So let's call it a measure of purity for the moment. Well, if rho is a pure state, well, then this is a little subtle to calculate, right? Because log of 0 is negative infinity. It's maybe easier if you look at rho diagonally. So right, so if you have a pure state that looks like this, and we take rho log rho, that will look like this. Well, it'll be 1 log 1, and then 0 log 0, and so on. When it's diagonal, it's enough to just do this formula on the diagonal things. And well, this is clearly 0. This is also 0, but it's maybe less clear. And the reason it's 0 is because this 0 is stronger than this minus infinity. Right? If you take epsilon log epsilon, and take the limit as epsilon goes to 0, then you get 0. So that's why we kind of define this as 0 in this extreme case. And so then we get all zeros matrix here, and then taking the trace, of course, gives you 0. So S of a pure state is equal to 0. And that kind of makes sense from a thermodynamic point of view, right? I mean, if you have, say, a thermal system, and you cool it down to its, but you cool it down to absolute 0, so it's not really thermal anymore, then if it has a non-degenerate ground state, that ground state has to be a pure state, right? And so by the third law of thermodynamics, its entropy should be 0, which is exactly what we're saying here. OK? So it's maybe worth at this point introducing another entropy, which is the Shannon entropy. So the Shannon entropy shows up in information theory, classical information theory. So the Shannon entropy is defined if you have a probability distribution. So we have a probability distribution pi. And of course, because the probability distribution, each of these pi's is between 0 and 1, and the total, the sum of them is 1. And then the Shannon entropy, which I guess, well, OK, I won't give it a name, is defined this way. And in that case, the log is basically always base 2. OK? And this, as you can see, looks very similar to this von Neumann entropy. And in fact, if you take a diagonal density matrix, so that's kind of the closest analog we have to a classical probability distribution. In fact, it's just basically the quantum version of a classical probability distribution. Well, you get exactly the same thing, right? Because if you take a diagonal density matrix, well, the eigenvalues have to be real, non-negative values, and they add up to 1. And if you take trace of rho log rho here, well, again, then you get, so if rho is this, then rho log rho is P1 log P1, et cetera, Pn log Pn, right? And taking minus the trace of this is just this Shannon entropy. Okay? And originally, when Shannon did this, I don't know if there was a clear notion of the connection. Supposedly, Shannon, who was working on information theory, knew von Neumann and asked, he was looking for suggestions as to what to call this quantity that he had discovered as being very useful for describing the amount of information you had. And von Neumann's suggestion was to call it the entropy because it has, you know, the same formula. And supposedly von Neumann said, and no one understands entropy anyway, so they won't argue with you. So nowadays we have a better grasp of the connection between the Shannon entropy and the von Neumann entropy. And in particular, in quantum information, it comes out a lot. But in quantum information, we can clearly see the von Neumann entropy as a generalization of the Shannon entropy to quantum systems. But there's this whole line of thought, which again, I'm not really going to go into in this class, but there's a line of thought of Landauer's principle that actually makes a concrete connection between the entropy of information and the thermodynamic entropy. And basically this point of view is that you can look at thermodynamic entropy as kind of the information that's hidden about your system because you're looking at a macroscopic state instead of the microstate of, you know, for instance, where every atom is, as opposed to just the global variables of pressure and temperature, et cetera. OK? Are there questions so far? Yeah.
So it's, in some sense, the von Neumann entropy is, you're just saying that we have some vector space, and you know, it's just the probability distribution only vector space.
Sorry, the von Neumann entropy is saying we have a density matrix.
Right.
Which, in some particular basis, is going to look like a probability distribution. But in an unknown basis, but the nice thing about the von Neumann entropy is it really is a basis independent of quantities because it involves a trace, which is basis. I guess that's not totally obvious. But yeah, I mean, if you expand log as a power series, then you can do that. Okay, so let me go on by stating some properties of the entropy. And then I'll say maybe a little bit more about how it relates to the time. So, well, first of all, if you have a d-dimensional Hilbert space, then, well, the entropy is non-negative. And the maximum entropy is the completely mixed state that has 1 over d along the diagonals. And if you calculate it, you'll find that that state has entropy d. Sorry, not d, log d. OK. It's also worth noting that so if S of rho is this maximal entropy, then the state is completely mixed. And if S of rho equals 0, well, that's equivalent to saying that rho is pure. I showed you over there that if rho is pure, that S of rho equals 0. It also works the other way. This means basically that there's no uncertainty about the state, right, which is conceptually kind of equivalent to saying that it's pure. OK. Another property is that if you have a bipartite system, that the entropy of the composite system, A, B taken together, is less than or equal to S of A plus S of B. I should say that because of the property of entanglement, entropy of composite systems can be more subtle than classically. In particular, if you have an entangled state, right, the entropy, if it's an entangled pure state, the entropy of the composite system is 0, even though the entropy of the subsystems is non-zero. Whereas classically, S of AB would have to be at least equal to the maximum of S of A and of S of B. It can be less than the sum because there can be correlations between them. But yeah. Right. So right. So that's the second law of black hole thermodynamics, right? Which is not quite the same as this, right? So if you have two separate black holes, it's true that the entropy of the joint state has to be less than or equal to the sum of the entropies. In particular, the entropy is just the area of the horizon, which is equal in that case, in that particular case, in the kind of classical limit. But obviously, when you start to interact these two systems, then things can change and the entropy can get larger. So this property is called subadditivity. And it only really holds in the static situation. If, again, this kind of situation where we have some joint state and we imagine it cutting it in half and looking at the subsystem. OK. So another property is called the triangle inequality, or the Araki-Lieb inequality. And what that says is that the density matrix of the composite system is at most equal to the difference in the entropies of the subsystem. Okay, what this means in the case of if the global system is pure, then that implies that this is zero. Right, the left-hand side is 0 then, so that these two things have to be equal. It's easy to prove this particular property from the Schmidt decomposition, but since I haven't done the Schmidt decomposition in this class, I wasn't going to prove that way. I mean, mean, I'm not really proving it now because I'm just asserting the triangle inequality, but this is true. So if you have, so this is one of the things that makes the entropy of one subsystem a good measure of entanglement. Because if you have some global system, and you look at, you know, shared between Alice and Bob, and you look at Alice's density matrix, take the entropy of that, that's the same as you get if you just look at Bob's density matrix and take the entropy of that. Okay? So that means that the entropy is not just a measure of a purity of one subsystem, it's actually a measure of entanglement of this composite system. Okay. But I should say that that's only true if the global system is pure, right? So why is it not true if the system is not pure? Well, because the problem is that then the global system has some entropy too, right? And that's just kind of randomness inherent in the description, and it doesn't really tell you anything. So if you have a completely random state, Alice has some random state, Bob has some random state, well, that has maximum entropy. And if you look at a subsystem, again, each of those subsystems has maximum entropy. But it's not an entangled state, it's a tensor product state. Okay? So it's only really a measure of entanglement when the system as a whole is pure. Okay. And then there's another property which is quite difficult to prove called strong subadditivity. And I'm not really going to use this and maybe not any of these other things in this class, but I think it's worth defining them for you. So strong subadditivity is if you have a three-party system, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. And it says that if you look at this particular combination, so if you look at the entropy of all three systems plus the entropy of one of the subsystems, then that's less than or equal to this combination of entropies. Okay, I don't know of a really intuitive interpretation of the strong subadditivity, but it turns out to be a pretty useful inequality if you want to start to do some non-trivial stuff with entropies. Yeah.
A maximally entangled state, pure state, are the entropy maximal?
Sorry, say again.
Right.
Yeah. So that's you. So okay. So you have to be a little bit careful. So if you have a system which is composed of two subsystems of equal size, then if you take a maximally entangled state, then both subsystems will have the maximal entropy. But if the two systems are of different sizes, well, if it's a global pure state, they have to have the same entropy, the subsystems, right? So they can't, if they're different sizes, they can't both be maximal. So in that case, well, it's not clear if you want to define a maximally entangled state in that system. But if you do, then they'll have entropy equal to the log of the dimension of the smaller subsystem. Okay? Okay, so I mentioned that this entropy is a measure of entanglement. So so what makes it a good measure of entanglement? So well, it has basically three properties that are really important here. So first, it's zero for tensor product states. In other words, unentangled states. And it's non-zero for entangled states. Okay, that's good, because that means it gives us a sharp distinction between the unentangled states and the entangled states. So again, this is S of one subsystem when you have a composite system. Okay. So another important property is that, well, it's kind of a basis invariant thing. It's not invariant under arbitrary basis, but it doesn't change under local unitary transformations on Alice or Bob subsystems. Okay, why is that? Well, I said that if you look at one system, the entropy is a basis invariant quantity, right? Because it involves the trace. So if you trace over Bob, then you're restricted to just Alice's system, and then taking the entropy is going to be the same in any basis. So in particular, if Alice makes a unitary rotation, that's equivalent to looking at it in a different basis, and the entropy will be the same. Okay. And then the third property is that the entropy is non-increasing on average under LOCC. Okay. So what is LOCC, and why does it matter that the entropy doesn't increase? OK, so we have Alice and Bob. And they might have some pre-shared state. But then once they have that, the only things they do are local operations. And we're going to let this be any, you know, POVM, any CP map, anything they want to do, so long as they're really local. And so the local operations, that's the LO part of LOCC. And then the CC part is they can also communicate classically. Okay, so that's what LOCC stands for, local operations and classical communication. And the idea is that this is kind of what Alice and Bob can do that is not, should not really change, or not at least it could decrease the amount of entanglement they have, but it shouldn't increase the amount of entanglement, right? Because they're only kind of doing the only non-local resource, the only one that the only new non-local stuff that they're adding is the classical communication. And that's not something that should increase the quantum correlations. So the idea is we want measures of entanglement to kind of quantify the amount of quantum, shared quantum stuff between Alice and Bob. And therefore, we're going to let them give the most possible thing they can do that doesn't increase the amount of quantum stuff they have. OK? And then it turns out that the entropy, I'm not going to prove this, but it turns out the entropy on average doesn't increase when Alice and Bob do LOCC. And that's maybe the in some sense, the most important thing that makes it a valid measure of entanglement. Yeah?
The entropy of subsystems.
The entropy, yeah, so that's right. So that's how I've defined it. The entropy of Alice's side or Bob's side. Obviously, the global entropy can increase because they can just flip random bits and. Okay. So it's maybe worth noting that the entropy is only not increasing on average. So actually, it can increase. Under some measurement outcomes. So for instance, here's a little circuit. So let's say they have alpha 0,0 plus beta 1,1 shared between Alice and Bob. So if they do this circuit, so this is the state psi, Alice adds an ancilla, does a controlled rotation, and then measures this state with R being this matrix, gamma delta minus delta gamma. Gamma equals alpha over beta, and delta equals root 1 minus gamma squared. Now, I'm going to assume that that absolute value of beta is greater than or equal to absolute value of alpha, and alpha is not 0, in order to make this thing an actual unitary. OK, so if they do this particular circuit, well, I won't go through the arithmetic, but it turns out that if Alice gets 0 here, then Alice and Bob are left with this state. So in other words, with probability 2 alpha squared, they have a maximally entangled state. Okay, and but on the other hand, if Alice measures 1 here, then they're left with this state. So that means that with probability 1 minus 2 alpha squared, which if you square this, that's what it comes out to, they have a tensor product state. Okay. So this is something that that Alice and Bob can do that will take a partially entangled state and sometimes give them a maximally entangled state, but sometimes it'll destroy the entanglement altogether. Okay. So this is why this property of being non-increasing on average under LOCC is really non-trivial, because they can do some things that will, you know, sometimes give them much more entanglement, and they can really do this. This class LOCC is really a very subtle and complex structure. And in practice, it's very hard to prove a lot of great stuff that we'd like to prove about LOCC. And so this is another topic that lots and lots has been written on. It's very closely related to the topic of types of entanglement. But we don't have a full grasp of it. And in the tutorial today, you'll see another way of getting maximally entangled states that are partially entangled states, but one that uses it kind of in bulk. So you have many, many copies of this partially entangled state, and you boil it down to fewer copies. And that problem should also give you a better understanding of why we like the entropy as a measure of entanglement. OK, so I'm over time, I guess, so I should stop there. But as usual, you can ask me questions outside or tomorrow.